Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Presented by Edmonton Motors.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
High noon on a beautiful Saturday afternoon in summertime. This is Nation Radio. We have Oilers stories of yesterday, today, and tomorrow. Major hockey news around the world, and there is some happening today. We'll get on that in a few minutes. Nation Radio brought to you by Edmonton Motors. Your questions are welcome. Please email them to nationradioteam1260.com or Twitter at It's Nation Radio or Low Tide. I also grab questions from the comments section at both Low Tide and Oilers Nation 2. We've got great guests today. Derek Zona from Copper and Blue and NHL Numbers. Corey Pronman from NHL Prospectus. He's becoming a prospect guru on the internet, and we'll talk to him a little bit. Also, Jonathan Willis from Copper and Blue and Cult of Hockey and Oilers Nation, and Corey Graham, too, play-by-play guy from the Edmonton Oil Kings. And our in-studio guest will be Guy Flaming just around the corner. Of course, we know him from the Pipeline Show as well. Okay, the big news this week in Oilers Nation, Nail Yakupov house shopping. That tells you exactly how much we're into the dog days of summer. And I think with the CBA chatter causing stomach upset and ulcers among the fan base, it's easy kind of to get down on things. But having said that, the mind-numbing CBA negotiations can only bring us down if we let them. And I can tell you from personal experience, I was distraught in 1994 at the baseball strike, and the last NHL lockout was difficult for me, mostly because Sportsnet promised me that the Swedish Elite League would be more interesting than it actually was. They were ghastly hockey games. If you watch them, you remember, dump it in, run, get it, dump it in, run, get it. This time, I'm going to celebrate the Edmonton Oil Kings and the Oklahoma City Barons, and hockey outside the National Hockey League. Also, some soccer, Tottenham Hotspur, FC Edmonton, Ajax in soccer or football, plus the Eskimos. You know, I'm not a smart man, but I will offer this advice. It only gets you down if you let it. And the silliness of the NHL lockout is going to appear probably in the next few weeks, and it'll run its course with or without me, and this time I'm choosing without. Now, we will have guests on the show who'll talk about the CBA. Tom Lynn is coming on next week. He's an expert at the subject. And of course, negotiations and all those things. And we'll talk about that through the, as it runs its course. But we're not going to make it a big issue. And we're going to celebrate hockey. And the Oil Kings are just around the corner. We'll talk about that as well today. Canada defeated Finland 4-0. Three goals from Nathan MacKinnon and one from Oil King Curtis Lazar. You know, it isn't exactly Seth Jones, too. But I'm going to ask our guests today, including Guy, about the MacKinnon obviously has to be the number one overall prospect, I think, as we enter the fall time and when these things get sussed out over the next several months. Also, Puck Daddy, if you're interested, has the Edmonton Oilers essentials up today. You have to have a look. Pat McLean from Black Dog Hates Skunks and Wood Guy, who is well known around the Allogosphere. They are the authors of that particular issue, and it's fabulous, great stuff. If you're a Gretzky fan, a Mac T fan, some really obscure stuff like Dave Brown, it's all on there. Check out Puck Daddy, Edmonton Oilers Essentials. And Scott Reynolds was a guest on Nation Radio last week, and we discussed Mitchell Moraz. He went out and did a wonderful comparable article this week at Copper and Blue, and the comps are impressive. And I'm not just talking about Lucic. Check it out at Copper and Blue. So there are some things you can do during the summertime if you're an Oiler fan, and those are a few that you might want to take part in. 5 minutes after 12, we welcome our first in-studio guest in a while. Probably the last time we had one was Guy Flaming, and it's Guy Flaming again. First of all, I want to say great, great summer shows. Anybody who's been listening can tell you that. But the scouts and these young kids coming in, this is great stuff.
Well, thank you for that, Alan. I appreciate that. And the reason I'm your in-studio guest all the time, it's pretty hard for me to say I'm not available when I was here 5 minutes ago.
Right. So you just do this as a pity thing, eh?
Oh, no way I can get out of it.
It's either Al talks for 20 minutes or I jump in. Everyone agrees that Hlinka is the beginning of the scouting season. Why isn't it on television or radio?
Yeah, I'm not sure why, really. It's awfully hard to follow, and I'm sure there would be a lot of people that would wake up early to watch it. I for sure would, and I'm sure you would as well. So I'm a little surprised that nobody's kind of picked up on it yet.
Well, they have, like, everything is on television. I mean, you can catch a war on TV. You just tune in CNN, and this isn't available. Maybe they're one major sponsor away. Maybe it's the fact that it's such a small area of, is it Czech Republic?
It's in the Czech Republic, yeah.
Brno or something like that? Or
And I think they play part of it in Prague, I think.
Okay, well, anyway, we'll get on that right away. We know McKinnon. We know some other names. Who are some of the names at the Hlinka that we should become aware of, aside from Jones, Lazar, McKinnon, that played well and should be on our radar now as fans?
Well, I think the netminder, Zach Fucali, plays for the Halifax Mooseheads. I think he's starting to establish himself as the top netminder for the draft next year. Eric Comrie is another one that was on the team, didn't play as much, who is going to be another goaltender of note. Max Domi is Ty Domi's kid. Small, doesn't play like his dad because this guy is all hands in another way. he's got a lot of skill. He had a 4-point game in this tournament already. So he's another guy. I don't have the list right in front of me, but there are a number of players. Jonathan Drouin, Anthony Duclair, both guys out of the queue will be first round picks, I'm sure. I thought the forward crop from this year's team was exceptionally deep. Morgan Klimchuk plays for the Regina Pats. He's going to be another one to watch for. And I think on the back end, guys like Josh Morrissey and Madison Bowie, they'll be the guys to watch for as well. So there are a number of players. I mean, you could look at this, the Canada's entry into the Ivan Hlinka pretty much every year and say all of those guys are going in the first three rounds.
Something like 17 of 22 years they've done the Hlinka, Canada wins the gold medal. It's crazy.
Well, it's because it's one of those tournaments where Canada is able to send the absolute best because there's nothing else going on, so nobody is tied up doing anything else. I mean, you look at the U18s in April, most of Canada's best players are still playing in the CHL playoffs, so you can't do it then. And the World Junior, a lot of the best guys who are available or eligible are playing in the NHL. So this is the one tournament for sure where Canada gets to send their absolute best.
I would love to see a Team Canada 1 and a Team Canada 2, because I think Team Canada 2 would work their butts off to be Team Canada 1, don't you? Like, if it was a Team 1 and they were all the best players, and then the second best would work like dogs to beat
Team 1. But why would you have an A team and a B team, though?
Because that's the best hockey.
Wouldn't you split it east and west?
No, I don't like that at all. You just these guys are the number one players, and you're number two. I'd like to see that.
They'd certainly be motivated.
Yeah, absolutely. How big is the gap between, or maybe there isn't, between McKinnon and Seth Jones?
I think it's minuscule, but, you know, I was talking to Pete Labardius on my show about this exact same thing. You go back, and how many times in the last 4 or 5 years has it been a forward followed by a defenseman in the draft? And you know, at times the defenseman there were arguments being made that the defenseman should go number one, but it never happens. You go, Drew Doughty was a great pick, but he went number two, and nobody's questioning Steven Stamkos as the first guy, and Jonathan Tavares and Victor Hedman, Ryan Nugent-Hopkins and Adam Larson. Larson bumps down to four, but nobody thinks he's a bad choice by any means. So is this going to be the similar case this year where it's going to be McKinnon and Seth Jones for the entire season, and there will be thoughts, Seth Jones is so good, he might be the best defenseman ever, and still goes number two? I don't know what it is. If NHL teams just value the forward more than the defenseman, it almost seems backwards, as Pete said, with the way the defensive game is so key these days. You know, for whatever reason, it seems to work out that way.
We thought, and I don't want to, this is old news, but I'll ask you one more time because I still don't really have a solid answer. Leading up to the draft, there was a lot of talk about the Oilers really like Ryan Murray. Mm-hmm. As it turns out, they went with the Russian Neil Yakupov. Did we ever find out, like, to me, it might have worked, and we don't know because Justin Schultz, I don't think, could talk to teams. But if they knew where you were getting Justin Schultz, then maybe taking Yakupov is the smart play.
Yeah.
But there did seem to be a lot of information out there in the ether about Ryan Murray.
And the Oilers will never open up publicly and say. I mean, I've certainly made some calls to find out. I have been told that Daryl Cates had a strong voice on who they wanted to take and who they ended up taking. That's not to suggest that Stu McGregor wasn't after Neil Yakupov as well. I was told there was a lot of debate, you know, between Ryan Murray and Griffin Reinhart, that if they decided to go with a defenseman, that it was a near toss-up between those two. In the end, they take Neil Yakupov, and, you know, the way he's wowed people already at the development camp in the summer, I don't think there are a lot of disappointed Oilers fans right now.
I don't blame Cates either, because if I owned the team, Pouliot would be the number one center. So
he's now starring in Switzerland.
Be like seven coaches. You make it work with Pouliot, or you're out of here.
Yeah.
How much are you looking forward to the season? Do you get all excited about this time? Because I've got Corey Graham coming on later, and he's bouncing off the walls here. So are you a little bit the same way?
Well, I am, but for a different reason. I've become less and less an NHL guy. And, you know, you talked about how, you know, the last time there was a lockout, it was really distressing for you. And I was the same way because I was a big NHL guy back then. But then that season we had the Edmonton Roadrunners in town. And that was, there wasn't a whole lot of media people going to watch, but I was there all the time and I got to sit with Craig Button and pick his brain all season. And I really got a lot out of that year. And that helped me become a lot more of a prospect guy.
He's a lot smarter now because of that year, too.
Yeah, well, it wasn't because he was sitting next to me, I'll tell you that. But, and I was working with HF at the time, Hockey's Future. And so I became a really staunch junior and college hockey guy. And if the NHL goes on has a lockout this year, I honestly, it doesn't bother me because the Edmonton Oil Kings are a phenomenal product
they
to
are.
Watch. I love the WHL. I love going to these games. And anybody who was in the playoffs or watching the playoffs last year, I can't see how you went to any of those games and won't be back this year because they're fantastic.
It's also fun as just a fan of hockey to watch. Like I saw Gernat a couple of times early and then I saw him. I didn't go to games for a little while and then I saw him later on and he had just developed like incredibly mm-hmm. over a period of maybe 2 or 3 months.
Yeah.
And so you can look forward to a kid like Lazar who really last year from where he started to where he ended up in the playoffs. Mm-hmm. So there's always a story, you know, to follow with when it comes to a junior team.
Yeah. And whether it's, you know, if you're an Oiler fan, there are 3 or 4 Oiler prospects on with the Oil Kings and maybe another 1 or 2 on the team that will be Oilers one yeah. day, you know, whether they get drafted or acquired by trade or signed as a free agent or something like that. And there are so many future stars in the NHL playing in the WHL. It's crazy. I mean, 2 years ago, Ryan Nugent-Hopkins was a star in the league and now he's with the Oilers and Oiler fans could have saw him 4 or 5 times a year when the Rebels came to town.
I don't want to put you on the spot and wide range here, but, you know, 2 or 3 spots will be fine. Where do you see Curtis Lazar going in the draft?
I wouldn't be at this point. I wouldn't be at all surprised if he went top 10. I don't know that he's top 5 yet, but I think by the end of the season, he could challenge for that sort of a position. I mean, he's a big, strong guy with great hands. I don't think he's going to get into the Nathan MacKinnon, Seth Jones kind of area, but I wouldn't be surprised at all if he's a top 10 guy.
He scored a goal today. MacKinnon got 3 and he got the
yep.
other one.
Yeah. Yep.
Oil Kings have some graduations, obviously. Pexic won't be back. Reinhardt might play those 9 games on the island, depending upon what happens with the CBA. Would that be their Achilles heel if those defensemen don't come back? Would that be the problem area?
Yeah, that is an area of strength on the team, but if you're going to lose both of those guys, I mean, that's really tough to overcome. Mark Pexic, I don't think anybody expects is going to be back, but they have... You know, Mason Gertsen is a big, tough, physical defenseman who played 30 games or so last year. He'll play a more prominent role this year. But they have a guy named Dyson Mayo who's going to come in this year. I think he's going to make the team. And Aaron Irving was a first-round pick at last year's Bantam draft. So he's going to be ready to play some this year as well. So they've got guys coming in their system. But I don't think they expect Mark Pesek back. But if they lost Griffin Reinhardt as well, and I think he's back with the Oil Kings this year. But if he does stick, that would definitely be a big loss.
Do you take me through your year? Because I listen to the show and I go online because your interview cachet is enormous.
Thank
and
you.
It's a great show for anybody who loves amateur hockey because you cover not just the Dub and the O and the Q, but the Tier 2 and then also the college of the U.S. colleges. So take me through your year starting like after the draft, I guess it starts, right?
Yeah, pretty much. Well, I mean, July is a tough month because for us, there's nothing going on. And then in August, all these tournaments start going, so we get going. So really September, I mean, training camps for the CHL open here right away. The Q started yesterday with exhibition games, believe it or not.
Wow.
And then in September, there's usually NHL training camps. So we're looking at guys who might stick in that league. And the CHL season starts in mid to late September, and college starts in October. Then you've got the World Junior at Christmas time. The Frozen Four is in early April. CHL playoffs, Memorial Cup. Then the draft, NHL Combine, there's lots of stuff.
How well do you get to know you had Morrow and Samuelson in here. How do you get to know them as people, or is it just on-ice stuff that you look at?
No, that's the attempt. We want to introduce them a little bit more and kind of get to know them a bit more for fans that are tuning in. I think how many times can you ask, which player do you think you play like, and what kind of things are you trying to improve on? after a while, I think those questions get boring for me as a as the guy asking them the questions, and I'm sure they get tired of answering them. So you try to do something a little bit different, get to know them a little bit better, and you know, talk to them about what they like to do away from the game and things like that. So we try to branch out a little bit more and get to know them a bit more on a human level.
And your partner's back sometime in the next 6 to 8 months?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I know he's going to be back on Tuesday night show.
Oh,
so.
Excellent. Well, that's good. Because I sort of remember what he looks like, but it's... what have you got coming up on Tuesday show?
I believe we are going to have a couple of agents come in studio with us on Tuesday for an hour. So we're looking forward to that one as well, and whatever else we got going will be planned between now and then.
Do you think... And I'm just asking this. I don't know, and it's not really even a fair question because, you know, you may not know the answer, but do you think there's a significant gag order on these guys as far as the CBA negotiations are concerned?
Well, we'll find out. I'm guessing they're probably not going to be talking a whole lot. Although, you know, you follow guys on Twitter, or at least I do, some of the agents, and some of them are pretty outspoken with their thoughts and opinions. So I guess we'll see what happens on Tuesday.
The other one, and this is the final question, the OHL, is it Windsor? They got nicked a little bit here. So are the other, because, you know, I mean, I follow the London Knights, they're the Schamp era, and then obviously, you know, Gagne went there and Kane, and you know, you hear stories. I don't want to be, you know, implying things that aren't, you know, true or proven, but you do hear stories. Are the other OHL teams kind of shaking in their boots right now?
I think there have to be a few, and London is probably one of them. You know, I've talked to, and again, this is all just based on what you're hearing, and it's not fact, and certainly not trying to imply anything, but London is a team that seems to find ways to get, they never seem to have a weak season, and you know, whether that's because teams are just, or players are attracted to play for the Hunters, who knows. Sam Gagne went there, he left the USHL to play in London, and the year he did, his dad happened to be an assistant coach there. You know, is that a coincidence? You know, I'm not saying Sam Gagne got paid to go, but, you know, is that a trade-off of some sort? That is, and then his dad, a couple of years, I think he was only there 2 years, and then he joined Vancouver. So I think there are things like that that go on, and I don't know necessarily that those are wrong things, but what Windsor has allegedly done is definitely against the rules, and if there are other teams that have done so, whether it's through getting American players or with the import draft, I think that might be the bigger issue. I think there are probably some teams, not just in the O, but in the Q and the Dub, that might be a bit nervous.
I lied. Just one final one.
Sure.
There's no chance Yakupov could be transferred in any way to the Oil Kings. Okay.
I don't know where that came from.
I don't know. I got like 4 or 5 emails and texts on that this morning. I'm like, I don't think they've ever done that. The last guy to play in two leagues, I think, was Dave Schultz, and he got booted out of one.
Yeah. No, the only way you go from one league to another is if you get released in one league by your team, and you basically clear waivers through, like, Jacob Deseres was a goalie with Brandon, who was cut by that team. Nobody else in the Dub picked him up. He went and played for St. John and got to the Memorial Cup and won in St. John. And, I mean, those are the only way. And Sarnia is not cutting Yakupov. No. And if they do, he's not getting waived through the league.
He'd probably make that club.
I think he would.
Guy, thanks a lot. Appreciate it, man.
Anytime, Al.
Guy Flaming from the Pipeline Show will take a break. This is Nation Radio, brought to you by Edmonton Motors.
This is Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Presented by Edmonton Motors.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
It's 12:23. This is Nation Radio. Around until 2 o'clock today. I'm Alan Mitchell, Low Tide, and joined by Connor Halley. How are you, bud?
Good, Alan. How are you?
Good. Did you get to were you at the football game last night?
I was, yeah.
Because I thought you were maybe at Specs Deck, the celebration there.
No, I wasn't even invited.
You're kidding.
Yeah.
Oh, man. You know, and it would have been good for you because you're young and, you know, you could do silly stuff at a party. They should have had you there. You know, could have been.
I'm getting called out on Twitter because of it. And
are you really?
Yeah.
Oh, man. Are you up to how many followers do you have now?
It fluctuates. 149-ish.
That's more than
before.
It goes
up and down. Yeah.
You were up to 152, though, the other day I saw that.
Oh, really?
Yeah. What's your hashtag?
Connor Halley.
Connor Halley.
It's just my name.
What is it?
Simple.
That's not hashtag, though. I said that wrong, didn't I?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right. The internet is a mystery to me. Once you're 50, it's all like, you know, it's not like an 8-track, you know. There's some adjustment. 12:25, we're joined now by Derek Zona from Copper and Blue. How are you, man?
I'm well. How about yourself?
I'm very well. I've got a lot to talk about here. So let's start with Copper and Blue and your top 25 under 25. With all these terrific talents, that's got to be a difficult top 5 or 6 to rank.
It is. It's interesting to watch the votes roll in. This year we added Alan Hull, another very good writer, to our ranking committee. You know, the one thing, except for your own Jonathan Willis, we were still unanimous with Taylor Hall. But after that, it gets murky and muddy. You know, there's six really, really good talents here and another five or six that everybody expects to contribute within the next year or two. So there's some different and varied opinions on where those guys should rank.
As you mentioned, Jonathan Willis, and we'll have him later in the show, did rank Nugent number one, everybody else Hall at number one, and I think that's what most people would say. How big a gap do you think it is between Hall and whoever everybody has at number two?
You know, Taylor Hall is a very, very special player. He is one of the premier young forwards in the league. At a very young age, he's already affecting play to an enormous degree. He's pushing play into the offensive zone. When he's there, he's creating a tremendous amount of scoring chances and shot opportunities. There's just a couple of guys since the lockout that have generated the shot volume and the possession metrics that he has. Hall is one. Landeskog is another. But, you know, those two are very, very special players.
Do you see the Oilers continuing to give him the zone start push, or do you think that at some point in time he's a guy that will start, you know, being able to play no matter what the circumstance and maybe give some of these other younger kids a little bit of a zone start push?
I think that they're at the point now where they've got to throw him in. You know, he's performed admirably no matter what kind of starts he's had. You know, his rookie season with Eberle and Horkoff, they took on a little tougher comp. They weren't as sheltered last season. He didn't get as much sheltering as Eberle and Nugent Hopkins, but he got, you know, a couple of tough games and tough assignments before injuries beset him. I think it's time to throw him in the deep end. He's, you know, a special player. He's going to dominate play. I'd be willing to say that, in a, you know, within this next year, he's going to be one of the guys that can dominate play against the best competition with even the tougher zone starts. I mean, he's obviously not going to be starting in the defensive zone. They've got guys like Belanger and Horkoff and Smith to do that, the heavy lifting. But if they were to put him on a line maybe with Gagne and Hemsky, I think they'd have a very special power versus power line supported by, you know, the Horkoff-Smith line that they can do the dirty work like Malhotra can in Vancouver.
Very interesting you mentioned Gagne and Hemsky because our new coach has mentioned them as a pairing and then also Nugent Eberle as well, kind of a duo, and then Hall sliding up and down depending upon, you know, who's doing well or what the situation dictates. Do you see that kind of thing working where you've got, it's almost like the old-timey Anderson, Messier, Gretzky, Curry, not to compare eras, but the duos and then you shift and move around based on how things are going or what the circumstance is in the game?
Yeah, I think it's a good plan. You know as well as anybody that, you know, by November 1st, injuries will have turned the pairings and the lines upside down, and whatever plan they have to be in the season kind of gets thrown out the window. And you know, they're going to have to protect Yakupov, although I think that he is closer to Hall in as far as performance and as far as possession goes than any other Oiler, and I think that, like Hall, he will be on the positive end of the possession game, and he'll be able to generate just a ton of shots. So I don't think he's going to have to be protected very long. It's going to be interesting how he manages, how Kruger manages that. It's one thing if they were, you know, stuck with just one talented line, but with two talented lines and three or four forwards that might need a little bit of push from zone starts, and you obviously would want to put them out against tough comp, especially with tough players like Horkoff and Smith, Hemsky. You know, those guys, they can handle themselves. So let them go out and take on the tough assignments, and you should have them paving the way for some very talented kids playing against lesser comp or with better zone starts.
Your top five, Derek, we're with Derek Zona, by the way, from Copper and Blue and NHL Numbers. Your top five is Hall, Yakupov, Petry, Nuge, and Gagne. And I got a lot of emails and PMs and DMs about your list and your top seven or so. I want to tell you that. So I'm going to ask you two questions, and I'll kind of clean them up from what was asked. One is your ranking of Jordan Eberle. This is a tough list. It's not like he's a talentless player, but your ranking of Eberle, where you have him, caught a lot of people by surprise.
Yeah, it has for a while, and you know, it's nothing against the guy. There's just some very good players in front of him. I think Yakupov and Hall are pretty much similar in their play. I think they are going to be the keys going forward to tilting the ice, essentially, and generating scoring chances. You know, I think the one that really got everybody was having Petry so high. But I've been, you know, I've liked him for a while, and he's an all-zone guy. He's a power play guy, penalty kill guy. He's going to lug the puck constantly. You know, I imagine in a couple of years, his critics are going to start talking about turnovers because he's just going to be a guy that's always going to have the puck and always going to be leaving the zone with the puck. And there's really no one else in the organization right now, in my eyes. You know, the Schultz is certainly a candidate for it, but you know, Petry's already proven, and he is you know, performed really well and with some not so good partners, and he's performed with Lottie Schmid first level competition. So you know, I bumped him up pretty high because he is a rare commodity right now for the Oilers. And if you're going to, you know, bring Petry up that high, you're obviously going to have to knock somebody. And in this case, it was Eberle.
Let's move on, because I could ask you 1,000 questions about that, but I want to move on to NHL numbers and the top 30 team previews that are going on, because they're a fascinating look at each club. It looks to me as though this is what... this looks like maybe an attempt or the idea came from the old Bill James abstracts, which is really to cut into last season, explain it, and then maybe overlap that with what the team is trying to do over the summer and then come to a conclusion. These are beautifully written, the ones that I've seen. Is that sort of the way that they're supposed to run? Is that what it's supposed to do?
Yeah, it's exactly the concept. We've got a number of talented writers, and organizing them, you know, I can't imagine how Kent does it, but you know, we've got 10 or 12 decent writers there who all have a bent towards the analytical, and what we're trying to do is just go back, review what happened, take a look at what was luck, what was talent, see if we can figure that out based on last year or a couple of years, explain that, or explain maybe one or two storylines that everybody's talking about, and then turn that around, look at the additions, and move forward and make the projections on this year. What we set out to do was examine all 30 teams, but allow each writer to play to their strengths and do their thing. You know, we didn't want to have a specific template or a specific manner in which we wanted to go through these and publish them. So it was essentially, hey, here's the gist of it. Go out and do your best. And we actually held a roto draft to pick the teams we wanted to write about in over an email string, and everybody picked up two or three teams, and away we went.
So give me the writers. I know Sharon's on. I know you. Who are the other writers involved?
Eric from Broad Street Hockey, who's really generating some amazing content right now.
Absolutely.
I think some of the best around. Jonathan Willis, Kent has picked up a couple of teams. Tom is writing about the Canucks for us. We've got Ben Wendorf, who we recruited from Arctic Ice Hockey. Gabe Desjardins coming over to write about the Sharks because they're local to him. And we've got a couple of other really good guys. The fellows behind Driving Play, Jared and Brent and Chase, they're writing. As well as Josh coming from defending Josh Lyle coming from defending Big D. So I don't know if I left anybody out or not, but it's a Scott Reynolds. I'm sorry, Scott Reynolds from Copper and Blue as well. We recruited him over to write a couple of these.
Well, they're brilliantly done, and I recommend anybody who has not read them. The Carolina Hurricanes, I came out of that I think, well informed about what they were trying to do. It looked like they were doing a lot of activity, but if you read exactly what the Hurricanes have done over the summertime, it makes a lot more sense. And I think that's what Bill James did. So my compliments to the entire group, because it's a real education, and you can't possibly go in knowing everything. And there's a lot of information on each of those 30. Now, when's the Oilers edition out?
They're going to come in at the very end of the month. I think they are in the maybe 6 days before the end of the month that they drop in. The last division we're doing is the Atlantic. The division prior to that is the Northwest. So they're going to drop in somewhere in there. And we will, I was talking to Ken about this, we will end up combining all of this, compiling all of it, and publishing it for free at NHL and NHL numbers as a one document, one page or one downloadable kind of e-zine, or I don't know what they call them now, but one reference point for everybody to download and read through. So look forward to that early in September.
Perfect. I'll really look forward to that. We're with Derek Zona from Copper and Blue and NHL numbers and various points on the internet. I always love reading your stuff about guys I like, because you I like Gagne, and you prove why I like him. And so I don't have to do any of the work, and you make me feel smarter. And now you're doing the same thing with Magnus Pajärvi, who is a guy who's been something of a lightning rod player. And I think a lot of it had to do with Tom Rennie maybe losing him a little bit at the beginning of last season. But you've written several times about Magnus Pajärvi, and in the last few days identified some impressive things about his second season, which on paper, looking at the box scores, doesn't look that good. How important are those possession numbers that we see from Pajärvi that you highlighted at Copper and Blue?
I think they're really important, and before I get onto that, I do want to say for some reason the two of us intersect when it comes to defending the downtrodden. Whoever's getting beat on on Twitter or on the message boards, we seem to come together for their defense for whatever reason. But priorities, he's the one remarkable thing about him is that even in the midst of all of the ridiculously bad luck that he had last season, he was still winning the possession battle. And, even if the guy is never going to become a 30-goal scorer, the value in a guy who can help to tilt the ice, the value in a guy who can take on some tough opponents and, turn it around. In the piece that I was talking about, his luck was just tremendously bad. And a guy that kind of mirrors that, and I picked this out earlier in the week, I'm going to end up writing about it, but Chris Higgins, who's a Canuck now, he started with the Canadiens and he scored 27, 25 goals, something like that, while he was shooting 15%. That came down the year after. I think he only shot maybe 12 or 10%, and he just maybe crept into the 20s. And then for a couple of years there, he was really in the wilderness where he was shooting 8%, 7%, 4%, and it was, Rangers fans made fun of him. Panthers fans made fun of the guy. He wasn't scoring goals. But at each point, he was still winning the battle. He was still driving play. In Florida, he was taking on tough minutes, often with Marty Riesner, an ex-Oiler, and he was able to win the possession battle and get the puck going the other way. And, I predicted that if Pajärvi's luck would turn around a little bit, and he was able to generate 200 shots a season, when he's generated 180 previously, you're looking at a guy who could score 15 goals a year. And 15 goals a year with 25 assists a year, that's a 40-point guy. And if you got a 40-point guy who can win the possession battle, that's really a top six forward in the NHL. By points, by the possession metrics, by everything, it's a top six forward. He's going to be very valuable going forward. And, the one thing that I expect from Kruger is he's going to mend those fences. He's going to build that relationship back with Pajärvi. I don't know if Pajärvi is going to start the year on the club, because I think the Oilers are still committed to a bruising, brawling, sandpaper and grit-filled fourth line. So I don't think that Pajärvi starts the year there, but I think the first hint of injury, he's going to come up. And given some of the linemates he may get, and you know, one of the things that to consider is he may end up on a line with Horkoff and Smith playing some of the tougher competition. And if he's still able to hang on and he's still able to contribute and win the possession battle and chip in 10 or 12 goals, I think it's going to be a really successful season for him and sets him up as just a really effective forward for, you know, 8 to 10 years in NHL.
So, and this is the final question, Derek, but I grew up a fan of the Montreal Expos, and they always had great young talent, but they were always shooting themselves in the foot at certain positions. And I'll use Tony Bernizard as an example. He was a guy who was a good, young, talented second baseman. It took him a while to develop, and they ended up trading him into Cleveland, where he played for 15 years. For the Edmonton Oilers to not lose out on a guy like Magnus Pajärvi, it's very important this year that no matter what happens when he comes up, whether he breaks with the club or whether he goes down to Oklahoma City and then gets inserted, that they have some kind of a specific role for him, correct?
Yeah, I agree completely. I think dropping him from, you know, place to place, from the fourth line, playing with, you know, one thing about him last year is he played a ton of minutes with Éric Bélanger, and, you know, the guys in the Edmonton media wrote about Bélanger's terrible luck and the worst slump of his career. Even to close the season, he was still in a terrible slump. But he would play with Blanger, he would bounce up with Gagne, he was, you know, he was up and down the lineup. And I think for a young player, it's difficult to adjust to. You know, Nugent Hopkins and Eberle last year, they really got their role. Guys, you're going to go out in the offensive zone. You know, somebody's going to push up the puck up the offensive zone. You're going to take a face-off, go score goals, and, you know, you're going to take on a little bit easier competition. And obviously that changed at the end of the year as teams adjusted. You know, Horkoff and Smith knew their role. Guys, you're going to go out and take defensive face-offs. You're going to push the puck out of the zone and hope for the best. For Pajärvi, up and down the lineup, not knowing who he's going to play with, you know, not really knowing if he's going to be the free-skating guy like Hopkins and Eberle, or is he going to be the responsible guy like Smith and Horkoff. I think that, you know, it's tough for a younger player to adjust to, especially one who is just mired in a slump. And, you know, one of the things about being in a slump is you start to do crazy things. You know, you start to take bad shots, you start to wait, you start to not pull the trigger. I think that really affected him a lot last year. Talking to Neil Livingston, who wrote for Copper and Blue about the Barons last year, he talked about how once Pajärvi got down there, he was free skating, setting up the play, wheeling around, you know, back to the kid who was his shirt was flapping in the wind as he was skating down the ice. And I think it's important that the Oilers you want to get back to that. Even if it's, hey, go out on the right wing for Smith and Horkoff, and you're probably only going to score 25 points this year, but you're going to be important because you're going to be the last line of defense for a team of really young, offensively-minded players. I mean, even that would be a huge move in Pajärvi's development.
Derek, thanks for this. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Alan.
All right. That's Derek Zona from Copper and Blue. We had wanted to get him on last week. I forgot to ask him this. He was at a blues festival. Do you know the blues festival that Derek was at last week? Did you? I got to get him back on because I love the blues. Are you a big blues fan? With your life, you should be. You know. I'm sorry. I'm such a jerk. Connor's a great guy. I'm just teasing. And somebody missed a big party that everybody's talking about on the internet today. It's okay because he wasn't invited, apparently. We're going to take a break. Corey Bronman is next. This is Nation Radio, brought to you by Edmonton Motors.
This is Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Presented by Edmonton Motors.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
It's 12:49. This is Nation Radio. We're running until 2 o'clock today. Jungle Jim Hunter on the radio at 2:00. And then we also have our friend Jeff Crichel at 4 o'clock this afternoon. Big game tonight at 7:30, by the way. Canada playing. We'll have that for you too. In the next hour, Jonathan Willis from Oilers Nation, Cult of Hockey and Copper and Blue, and Corey Graham, Oil Kings play by play. He is excited about the Oil Kings and why not. They won the Western Hockey League this past year, played in the Memorial Cup, and it looks like they'll be one of the favorites, I would say, maybe even the favorite, entering the WHL season. We'll talk to Corey about that coming up later on next hour. Joined now by Corey Pronman from Hockey Prospectus. How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine, Alan. Thanks for having me on.
Well, you know what? We appreciate you coming along. I wanted your impressions of the recently ended four-game Canada-Russia series. Who impressed you, and who maybe didn't impress quite as much as you thought they would?
Well, in terms of the Canadian team, Luke Szczesny was a guy that I really caught my eye throughout the entire four-game series. He went, I believe, in the second round to Phoenix in the two drafts ago, and he was a guy that during his draft year was a player kind of knocked by inconsistency, but his previous OHL season was very solid. Heard a lot of good things about him, and just he had all his best skills on the forefront in that series. High-end speed, good work ethic, has some skill. So he was definitely a guy that stood out. Ryan Murphy also was a guy that's been looking to rebound ever since his season was kind of knocked off his course by a concussion injury. And, I mean, in the two games he played in Canada, his skill level was quite evident. This is a guy that can create offense at will. So those are just a couple of examples of guys that really stood out to me. Is there any other guys you had questions about in particular?
You know, just we'll move on to the Russian squad now, and I'll begin by asking how everyone let this Slepshyov, or whatever his name is, go through. You had him rated quite highly, and it looks like that had merit because he looks like an outstanding young hockey player.
Yeah, Anton Slepyshev. He was one of the three players on the Russian roster to not be a 1993 birth date. The other two were first-round picks, and Mikhail Grigorenko from Buffalo and Andrei Vasilevsky with Tampa Bay. This is a guy that scored in his 17-year-old season in the KHL at comparable levels to what Kuznetsov and Tarasenko did during their own 17-year-old seasons. And I mean, the reason that I was hearing why he went through the draft is he made a clear impression to teams that he was not coming over anytime soon. And that's just the nature of the business right now when it comes to these Russian players, especially those who are playing overseas, is not only is it just the talent level, but they need to see a clear commitment to you coming over. Otherwise, they're not going to want to use one of their seven picks on you. That being said, I obviously disagreed with him going unselected. I think that even though he made it clear he was not going to come over, I think his rights were worth at least a fifth, sixth, seventh round pick for its potential value should you ever actually again to come over, because there's no time limit in terms of how long you own his rights, seeing as there's no transfer agreement. But, I mean, I love the kid. Highly skilled, skate, shoot, has all the tools. It's just get him overseas.
Well, it brought up an interesting, that's one area of the draft that I found interesting. The other was, I was obviously following the Edmonton Oil Kings quite a bit this year. They had some defensemen like Sautner as an example. There was a very fine young goaltender in Saskatoon, Russian, playing for the Blades. They fell through as well. But it seemed as though NHL teams were drafting 19, 20-year-olds, overage draft. Lalicia is somebody that you had highly ranked who went to Edmonton. Is that maybe part of it? NHL teams are looking for maybe kids who are, if not more developed, a little older, and they know that what they're going to be getting?
Well, again, the draft, when you're doing your prospect homework, you're not just looking at 17-year-olds. Kids develop so much. I mean, you just see when you're looking at, like, draft lists, in August, you see how much they change from August until April or May of during that same draft season, because players change so much in a small amount of time. And that just happens with those 18 and 19-year-olds. Some players who just weren't that good at 17 are all of a sudden great at 18, and vice versa since 18 to 19. So it's all part of the process. I don't see any particular trend.
I've always argued that draft and follow would be better than getting a 19 or 20-year-old player. And I guess the parallel would be in baseball, where some teams prefer to draft college kids and others would like to have a high school pitcher or whatever the case may be, a younger player, high school guy. I guess both can work, but is one likely to be better than the other? And I guess the high school kids would be more, they might have more upside.
Right, well, you mean you're talking about high school, or you're just talking about drafting 17-year-olds
in
general? Yeah,
17-year-olds. Yeah, I used the analogy and carried it too far, but yeah, 17-year-olds.
Right. Well, again, the most talented kids in hockey tend to be identified as 17 because they're playing in the CHL by then, they're playing major international events. It's very rare that really talented kids get passed over as 17, but you have your odd examples here and there, and usually those kids are the ones who actually play American high school or play in the BCHL, stuff like that. And a player that Oilers fans will be familiar with, Justin Schultz, the guy who just really developed as he hit his 19, 20, 21-year-old seasons. And this is a guy who had even more value than just the similar player in terms of talent level, because he was further along in his development track. You knew how he was going to play and just how his overall game was rounding out into his early 20s. So that gave him a lot more value. But that kind of player is very rare. And like I said, most of the top talent goes at 17.
So, you know, you mentioned Justin Schultz. That slides into my next question. Is there a group of players that you could, like four or five or six players that you could name now who, should the NHL season get underway at some point, would be considered favorites to win the Calder Trophy?
The thing with the Calder is so hard. I could say who I think the top prospects are, but the Calder Trophy depends on usage. I mean, you can be the most talented player in the world, but if you don't get ice time, you're not going to win. Not going to win that award. I mean, the top guys that come to mind for me are Michael Granlund from Minnesota, Vladdy Tarasenko from St. Louis, and Neil Yakupov, obviously from Edmonton. Maybe you could throw Justin Schultz in there, but defensemen usually don't win that award. Kyle Palmieri from Anaheim, and then you have like the older two players that just signed from overseas, Roman Cervenka with Calgary and Damian Brunner with Detroit. Not as talented as the guys I named, but because they're like 25, 26 and are actually eligible, I think Brunner is actually 27, and they're both eligible for the Calder Trophy just because of that age gap that could help them become candidates.
The Ivan Hlinka has just finished up with Canada winning 4-0 against Finland, McKinnon scoring a hat trick. This is a kid who is going to force his way into the picture very early this fall, obviously, and the number one, you know, projected number one overall. Does he shape up as being a guy who we can look toward seeing at the World Junior Championships?
Yeah, I think so. I think it would be very hard for him to stay off the roster, especially since I think Jonathan Huberdeau, should there be a season, of course, will likely be with Florida. There's a decent chance you're going to lose at least one of Ryan Strome or Mark Scheifele to the NHL. So I don't see really a way that he's not on the roster barring injury, and he's just a fantastic prospect. Again, it's only August and a long ways to go, but to me he's shaping up to be the best draft prospect I've seen since Tavares.
Wow, okay, so that's going back several years now. Speaking of World Junior rosters, how are they looking right now? Obviously, you know, you spoke expertly about the center position. How many players at that Ivan Hlinka might we see? And then on the Canadian roster, how 18 and 19 year old heavy is it going to be?
I mean, outside of McKinnon, I mean, I've heard Sam Reinhart being discussed a lot. Had a great tournament, but I mean, the World Juniors is an 18- and 19-year-old tournament, especially for a team like Canada that have just so many good players in that age range. It's outside of someone like McKinnon, it's really hard for anybody who's 17 to make that team. You think back to Tyler Seguin getting cut by Canada. The rosters, you see who their top names are looking for. It's just by the guys that are invited can't play for the team. I think Mark McNeil and Duncan Siemens might be able to get into the mix later into the season. But I mean, the top names you see there are guys that I think are mostly going to be in the contention come December.
So, and then the other side of that is if there is a lockout, you could see something like the North Dakota team for Canada, where it was a stellar, ridiculous hockey club.
Yeah, I mean, that's a thing there. I mean, actually, from my perspective, as much fun as it is to see all those top names, I like it when it's all the lesser names because it helps me see some guys who you don't often have an opportunity to get a look at. But I mean, as you remember back in the last lockout, that team was just stacked. So I'm pretty sure Canadian fans will love for another lockout, at least from a junior perspective.
Final one, and this is a two-prong question. We've talked about McKinnon being, you know, obviously, it's early, but a number one projection. Seth Jones, number two, and how big is that gap?
To me right now, McKinnon is the clear one and Seth Jones is the clear two to me. I mean, I know those are the two names being debated a lot, but not only do I see there's definitely a slight to moderate talent gap, in my opinion, between McKinnon and Jones, but also the positional difference makes it a no question for me that McKinnon will be number one person on my draft board, and Seth Jones will just be right behind. I mean, I think the world of Seth Jones. He's an elite prospect, but you can't put a defenseman at number one. But Seth Jones definitely has a good case to be number two.
So if Tavares was a great number one, and McKinnon's going to be a great number one, were the Oilers unfortunate in finishing with the first overall pick 3 years, the 3 years they chose?
I mean, unfortunate, if I wouldn't use that kind of phrasing, but I mean, you can't control that. And I don't think there's like this giant gap between what McKinnon is and what Taylor Hall and Neil Yakupov are. I just think he's just like a slight notch higher.
Okay, good. Hey, Corey, thanks for this. I really appreciate it. We'll have you on again as the summer rolls along.
No problem, Al. Thank you.
All right, that's Corey Pronman from Hockey Perspectives. Read his stuff. He's going through all the teams now and their top prospects. And his Oiler one, which has been online for maybe 2 weeks now, 2 or 3 weeks, stellar stuff. He's really good, and he knows his stuff, so we thank him very much. Jonathan Willis on the way. This is Nation Radio, brought to you by Edmonton Motors.
This is Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Presented by Edmonton Motors.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
And we are back with Nation Radio at 6 minutes after 1 o'clock. And of course, this is hour number two. We're going to be talking to Jonathan Willis. So,
What you talking about?
How are you, Jonathan?
I'm doing great, Alan. How are you today?
Good. I've been thinking about you and Ernest Hemingway. And the reason is because Hemingway had a unique way of going about his business when he wasn't writing anything. And I'm thinking about the lockout, and I worry about you if you have Hemingway's habits when you're away from the typewriter.
I not only do I not have Hemingway's talent, but I don't have his habits either, so no problem on any score there.
Okay, I was just worried. I thought this is where it went downhill for Hemingway when the lockout happened. What are you going to write about if there's a lockout, buddy?
I think we'll probably spend a lot of time in Oklahoma City. The thing about a lockout is if you look at the last one in 2004-05, a lot of what happened the next year really was generated by that lockout. So looking at the Oilers specifically, Sean Horkoff before the lockout was kind of a 40-point player that most people pegged as a third liner. And Alex Hemsky hadn't really emerged. Those guys both went to Europe. They had great years in Europe. They came back. They had superb seasons in Edmonton. The team Edmonton met in the finals, Carolina. Eric Staal was a 35-point rookie the year before the lockout. He went down to the lockout, played a point per game over a full AHL season, came back and was a 100-point guy for Carolina when they made their run to win the Cup. So I think as much as I'd like to watch NHL hockey next year, if there is a lockout, there are still going to be stories, and it's something we want to keep an eye on so that we can kind of project what these guys are going to do when they come back after the lockout.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that because it really did. I remember the Edmonton Roadrunners team, Guy Flaming and I were talking about it. The Rafi Torres, Jarrett Stoll, Kyle Brodziak had a big year that year. What maybe was it? I guess the AHL was a better league that year then, and these kids were allowed to develop maybe away from the microscope.
I think so, and I'm a big fan of the Detroit method of developing players, just where you put them in a position where they can succeed and you don't move them up until they're ready to succeed at the next position. And it's something that Edmonton has struggled with over the years. So when there is a lockout, it forces them to kind of put these guys at a lower level of hockey. I mean, the AHL during a lockout is very, very good hockey, but it's not the same as playing full-time NHL minutes either. And I tend to think that's good for players. It's good for their development. Even the high-end guys on the Oilers right now who are without question legitimate NHLers, I can't see it hurting them. I think it's a helpful step, and it's too bad that it takes a lockout to bump guys down to the minors and get them into that place where they can really excel. But it's interesting to watch.
It would also, I think, Tyler Pitlick, Curtis Hamilton, those types of players, it would possibly force them to work hard again for playing time, which isn't always a bad thing.
Yeah, that's the one thing. I think you have to worry a little bit that a guy like a Curtis Hamilton gets lost in the mix. But I think the true talent, the really high-end guys that are going to have careers are going to play well anyway.
I'm going to go. I've got a couple of email and PM questions I'm going to throw at you. This one comes from Cactus saying, is or was there a reasonable and not overly expensive way for the Oilers to upgrade their defense this offseason? Some people maintain that Tamberlini should have done more, while others, like myself, have defended him on the grounds that we want no part of $5 million plus for guys like Weidman or trades like Foligno for Mathot. What's your thought on that?
Yeah, I tend to agree that a lot of the high-end defensemen were quite expensive. He mentions Mark Mathot. That was a big payment by Ottawa to bring him in. And do you really want Dennis Weidman inked for 5 years and $5 million plus dollars? I don't know that you do. With that said, I don't think there's a real excuse for not doing more than they have. Every year there's always some kind of bargain guy they can get. And in the Oilers' case, they've got a lot of names, but they don't really have that that mid-range talent. They do have guys, but they could use more. They've got in Sutton and Peckham and Potter, they've got eight defensemen, but those bottom three are all really six, seven, eight guys. You don't want them playing big minutes on your depth chart. So what the Oilers could have done is done something like what Nashville did. They went out and signed Scott Hannon for $1 million. He'd be an upgrade, I think, to that position. And then there's a free agent like Michael Roosevelt, who has not yet signed, who probably wouldn't cost that much. So there are bargains to be found, and I think the Oilers should have done a little bit more, but we'll see. I mean, landing Justin Schultz is an upgrade, and it's hard to fault them for landing the most coveted free agent on the market.
I agree with you totally. I think the Schultz deal, the problem with Schultz is we haven't seen him. So
yeah.
It's easy to go, oh, yeah, no, we got him, and then forget about him 5 minutes later, which is what I've done all summer. That's a nice addition. There's no doubt about it. You wrote a 10-points article on Oilers Nation, and there were a couple I wanted to get to. First of all, it kind of dovetails with what we talked about a minute ago. There was a great passage about the Red Wings and their procurement department over the years. Glenn Sather used to do this, too, where the current Oilers don't do it. They're all about procuring young talent. But the Red Wings do a really nice job. You use Dan Cleary as an example. There are others of maybe bringing what we might call scrap heap players or replacement level players into training camp, offering them a small contract or maybe even just an invite, and then grabbing the best of those and upgrading their team that way.
Yeah, and Chris Draper, Dan Cleary, there's tons of examples. The quote that I ran with from Ken Holland was about Slava Fetisov, who was a healthy scratch in New Jersey. He played just a handful of games in 94, and they traded a third-round pick for him. And he was a big factor in the 1997 Stanley Cup win. He was an integral part of the 98 team that won the Cup. He was a useful player. I think he scored at a point per game pace after they picked him up. And I guess what I'm getting at is these guys don't always work out. So you can't say, oh, you got to sign these guys and he'll, you can't always project best case scenario. But what Detroit does is they grab veterans. They don't ask them to do too much. They put them in the lineup. And if they work, they advance them. They don't just write a guy off because somebody else wrote him off. And I think sometimes there's a tendency to do that. And the nice thing is, as long as you're not overpaying, like when Edmonton signed Cam Barker, they paid premium dollars. It was only a one-year deal, but they paid premium dollars to bring him in. That's not what you want. You want to bring these guys in for what their value is now, and then if they exceed that, great. It's all gravy.
The other item that you mentioned in that article was about Ben Eager, who is an interesting player because, you know, he skates so well, Jonathan. And, you know, I mean, when he scored a goal, I can't remember what game it was, but he just stood in front of the net and just cranked the goalie pads until the puck went in the net. And I'm like, see? And that's the problem with Sam Good, right? This is a guy who, you know, has a value. He's big. He's strong. He's a fourth line guy. But expecting him to project farther up the lineup or inserting him into the fifth spot in the batting order is just not a good plan.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, I know exactly what you're talking about because there was half a dozen games last year where you watched Ben Eager and you said, wow, this is a legitimate power forward. Why doesn't this guy get top 6 minutes? Because that's how good he was in that individual game. But I mean, he's 28 years old. He's played 400 odd NHL games. This is what he is. He has those games where he's really good because he does have the physical talent to be an impact player, but he hasn't been able to put it together. And at some point you say, okay, this is what he is. And I think we're there with Eager. He's a guy who will have those good games. Then he's a guy who will have terrible games and take penalties. I think back to the New York Islanders game last year, about the middle of the year, I think he had four minors in that game. And he basically handed the game to them with his penalties. And that's part of the package. You put it all together, he's a decent fourth liner who can move up the lineup some nights, and some nights he's a liability.
And he's not J.F. Jacques, so it's an upgrade. Right?
Yeah, he's not J.F. Jacques, so that's a good thing.
Yeah, no, sure. And, I mean, Jacques had injuries and other things, so I'm not being negative about J.F. Jacques, but Ben Eager, you know, can hold down a fourth-line job, score 8 goals a year, play 6 minutes a night, and the Oilers value that, so there's a value there.
And Jacques might have been a better player, too. Like you said, that he had that back injury, and I think it just destroyed him.
Yeah, no, it did for sure. Changing gears a little bit, we're with Jonathan Willis from Oilers Nation, Cult of Hockey and Copper and Blue. NHL numbers, I talked to Derek Zona about this. The site is ripping up the summer, and I love these, and I call them Bill James abstract review and preview issues. These are outstanding. For those who haven't read them, I'm trying to encourage them to go there. Tell me about why you value them, and I'll tell you why I value them.
Are we talking about the team manual?
Yes.
Yeah. I think it's interesting because the people that we have writing there are all very smart people. There's a long list of names. I won't list it off, but they're bright people. They really put teams under a microscope, and they examine them from a perspective that isn't generally present in mainstream publications, where they're looking at what happens when a team scores this many goals and allows this many? What does that mean going forward? What happens when you remove a player like a Lidstrom from a team like Detroit? What happens historically when that occurs? And I think it's a unique perspective. And the nice thing about it is because there's such a diverse set of writers doing it, you get a different perspective with each piece. So I find myself reading this, even a team I'm relatively familiar with, and it makes me think about them in new ways.
Well, I love I think it's Sharon has the Habs one out today, and he did a great job of saying what they had done in the first half and what they didn't do in the second half, and then what they needed, and it brought to a crescendo where they said they basically did nothing. And it really, to me, it's a thumbnail sketch. It's about maybe a 10-15 minute read, but it just gathers all the information up in one place and then puts it there so you can kind of have it in concrete terms.
Well, yeah, and I mean, it's impossible to be really dialed into all 30 teams unless you have basically unlimited time. So this gives you an opportunity to just quickly get a thumbnail sketch and come away with a better understanding.
The other thing I wanted to talk to you about is the top 25 under 25, which is at Copper and Blue. You took part in that. That's an interesting exercise, isn't it?
Yeah, I actually started the Copper and Blue a few years ago, as you undoubtedly remember, but Derek Zona, of course, and Scott Reynolds are doing a fantastic job running the site now. And the one thing that I come back for every 6 months is the top 25 ranking. And it's an interesting exercise because it looks at all the players under 25. So your typical prospect list just looks at the prospects in an organization, and it doesn't really give you an appreciation for the young depth on a team. Whereas when you go through all the players under that age, you really kind of understand where they are.
Well, I was interested in your specific top five or so, and I'll tell you why. As much as I love Taylor Hall, and I think that Neil Yakupov is going to be an outstanding player, the one guy who is kind of a I don't know, like super freak, to you know, borrow from Rick James, is Ryan Nugent-Hopkins, because as much as we know about him, there's a lot that we, like, if he ends up doing what he did this past year again, who could be in front of him, right?
Yeah, and I was the only guy who ranked Ryan Nugent-Hopkins number one. Everybody else had Hall number one, and it was based on that long-term upside primarily. Because his ability this past year was just off the charts good. His ability to impact a game offensively at the age of 18 was better than what we saw from Taylor Hall in his rookie year. It's better than what we saw from Eberle at an older age in his rookie year. It's really unparalleled, even with the list of talent that this team has, and especially later in the year. Because Tom Rennie, one of the things he did was he made Nugent-Hopkins' ice time tougher as the year went on. He started him off with lots of time in the offensive zone, weakest opposition he possibly could. And as the year went on, the opposition got a little better, a little better, a little better. And he started doing more work in the defensive end. Mm-hmm. And despite that, his play improved. And I think when you look at that and you say, okay, he's playing tougher minutes now and he's doing better than he did when he broke into the league, it really makes you wonder where his ceiling is. He's a guy, he could be a 100-point player at the prime of his career.
Well, the Ryan Nugent-Hopkins already, and is still a teenager, obviously, 18 years old, when he would, there'd be a possibility of a two-on-one, and you'd sort of see it because you can see the whole ice. What I was amazed by about this kid is that as many times as you see that develop on the ice as an observer and realize that the player holding the puck doesn't see the play. This guy sees the play. He just has I always hesitate to bring up Gretzky because it's totally unfair, but he does seem to have a sixth sense or eyes in the back of his head, right?
Yeah, his vision, his hockey sense, and his ability to read the play is uncanny almost. Robin Brownlee brought up Doug Weight as a comparison early on, and he brought him up again here a few days back. And I like it. I think that's the last center that I personally saw in Edmonton with just that ability to know where what was happening with the play and to put the puck where it was going to go. Now, I'm not saying that Nugent Hopkins isn't going to be better than Weight down the road, because he might be, but that's the only guy that I've seen recently that I can compare him to.
You and Robin are obviously forgetting Pouliot, but I'll forgive that. The Cult of Hockey, I always love reading your stuff over there, and you do a lot of great work over there. I noticed that the entire cult is going to be doing some zone possession stuff here when the season starts. Tell me about that project.
Yeah, so you've had Eric T. from NHL Numbers and Broad Street Hockey on a few times. So it's basically his project where he's tracking what teams do to enter the zone. So he tracks which player brings the puck into the zone, how the puck gets there, and what happens. What he found was that carrying the puck into the zone was a much safer play defensively and was way more likely, I think three times more likely thereabouts, to result in a goal or a scoring chance than dump and chase style. And so what it did was it really emphasized which players in Philadelphia, the team they were tracking, which players were able to carry the puck into the zone and maintain possession. So which players could transition from the neutral zone to a scoring position in the offensive zone. And that's something that's not really being tracked. It's not something that we can really know statistically. I mean, shot metrics and Corsi give us an idea, but they don't give us specifics of who's controlling the play that way. And I think Edmonton is a prime team to look at from that angle, because they do have players like Hall, players like Hemsky, players who carry the puck into the zone. And I'm very curious to see which guys really excel at it and which guys are maybe leaning on their line mates a little more. Now, the other half of it is also zone exits. And this is something that hasn't been done, to my knowledge, anywhere else. And we're going to track which players are doing the same thing, but in reverse, getting the puck out of the defensive zone safely. So puck handling defensemen, I think, are often undervalued in Edmonton, guys like Tom Gilbert, guys like Jeff Petrie, because we focus in on the turnovers, but we don't really appreciate how big of a job they're doing moving the puck out of the zone. I watched a game, and I was tracking this. I tracked it a few times last year, and Petrie and Theo Pekka were on a pairing, and every time the puck moved out of the zone, it was Jeff Petrie making the pass. Theo Pekka didn't clear his own end once. He'd get the puck, he'd pass it to Petrie, Petrie would advance it. And, I mean, Peckham's not going to rack up any giveaways playing that style of hockey. And so by looking at who's moving the puck out of the zone, we can kind of put giveaways in context. We can understand which players are coughing up the puck, but why they're doing it, because they're being relied on to advance it.
And then you've got forwards, Jonathan, like Aleš Hemsky, who are like, give it to me, baby. I'm going to take it, carry it into the zone, maybe do a curl or something, but I'm going to gain possession that way. That should show a higher value for guys like Hemsky and Taylor Hall then, too.
Yeah, Hemsky was the guy up front that I was specifically thinking of, because he does some things. Like, we've all seen him go 1-on-4 and side a little bit when he loses the puck, but he carries the puck into the zone. He gets the attack set up more often than I would guess anybody else on the team, though I don't know that because we haven't tracked it yet.
Jonathan, thanks for this, buddy, and we'll have you back soon again.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Alan. Thank you.
All right. That's Jonathan Willis, who is, of course, from Cult of Hockey, Copper and Blue, Oilers Nation, and more. He gets around because he writes so much, and he does not have the personal habits of Ernest Hemingway. So there's every chance he'll be here in the fall. You don't know about Hemingway?
I tried to Wikipedia it, but
See, that's what the great thing about your generation is. You could read like a Hemingway book and then you would know a little bit about his style and why he's special. But no, just I have no time for that. I'm busy. I got to get to Wikipedia. You know, there you go. I think there's even a movie that might help you with him. But anyway, interesting sort. We've got Corey Graham coming up, Oil Kings play-by-play guy, excited about the season just around the corner. We'll check in with him next. This is Nation Radio, brought to you by Edmonton Motors.
This is Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Presented by Edmonton Motors.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
It's 1:29. This is Nation Radio. We're around until 2 o'clock today. Jungle Jim Hunter on the way at 2, and then our friend Jeff Crichel at 4 o'clock this afternoon. So very busy afternoon. If you missed it, the Hlinka is over. Canada winning 4-0 against Finland. McKinnon scoring 3, and Curtis Lazar, Edmonton Oil King, getting the other goal. So good news for him as he gets ready for what will be a very important year in his career. Joined by Corey Graham, Oil King's play-by-play guy, who'll get to watch all of those games. Corey, how are you, sir?
Pretty good, Alan. How are you?
I'm very well. Are you enjoying this beautiful weather?
Yeah, absolutely. It's the time outside today, enjoying the nice weather, and getting forward to heading back inside a rink pretty soon.
Well, of all the guys who gets to enjoy summertime, I worked with Rod Phillips for a long, long time, and he's a guy who spent lots of time in cities and, you know, on buses and planes and stuff. It's a tough gig because you're indoors a lot during the wintertime, but I guess the other side of it is you get extended stretches during the summer where you can just kick back and enjoy.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I took some time off once the Oil Kings got back from Memorial Cup, had a nice stretch off there, and kind of had alternating weeks off in August here as well. So it's kind of nice, and yeah, obviously right around the corner getting real busy, so looking forward to it.
I saw Mr. Samuelson in here earlier today. I guess the memories of the draft are distant now, but the Oil Kings have done very well at the draft table the last 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, you mentioned Henrik there. Obviously, you know, he was on with Guy talking about how he wasn't a draft pick. He was signed, but they've obviously done good at the Bantam draft, and they've also done good having their guys move on, obviously, with Mitch Barraz and Griffin Reinhart and Henrik Samuelsson this year, and, of course, Mark Pesek graduating, and all the guys, the four of them that went last year as well. So they've been pretty highly represented at the NHL draft, and that's kind of what you expect when a club is sort of, you know, through expansions and building towards becoming a real competitive and top-level team.
You know, and we don't want to get ahead of ourselves, Corey, because it's a long year and, you know, Curtis Lazar is a highly touted player. But in talking to the guys that I, you know, kick back with, and that's Kirk Ludicky and a few other guys, this is a fellow who's probably top 10 at this point and entering, you know, his draft year. There's going to be a lot of eyes on Curtis Lazar.
Yeah, I think so. I think you're right, Alan. You know, I think he probably comes in as sort of an outside top five guy, probably top 10 guy right now. But, you know, a guy that didn't play a ton of first line minutes at all last year in the Western League, didn't play first unit power play or much power play at all early in the year as well. So I really think that the door's wide open for him to really step in this year and have a real good season. Obviously, I think he's going to play with Samuelsson and Stefan Legault. That line was so good in the playoffs through the Memorial Cup. And, you know, I really think this is a year for him that he could really blow the doors off if he comes in and plays like he has been. And obviously had that great run at the Hlinka you mentioned there that just wrapped up. He scored a few goals over there, and I know I talked to him before he went over, and he was he's just raring to go. He can't wait to get in the rink and get into camp and show what he can do now in a more of an offensive role.
With training camp is just around the corner, right? When does it start?
Camp gets going. Rookies hit the ice on Friday.
Oh my God, so you must be bouncing off the walls right now.
Yeah, absolutely. I've had this last week off, and I'm doing some afternoon stuff with Speck and Gregor gone next week, and then pretty much into full-out Oil King mode. So I'm really looking forward to, yeah, getting out of Fort Saskatchewan, and they have the tournament, of course, in Service Place in St. Albert on the long weekend. So they'll have a couple games there. It's 3 games a day on Sunday and Monday. So, yeah, a lot of time spent indoors coming up here.
Were you at Speck's deck last night?
No, I was not. Actually, my parents in town here, so I've kind of been entertaining a little bit the last couple of days.
Okay, Connor didn't get invited. He's kind of bummed about it, but I understand it was a great party. So,
yeah, usually is, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Connor doesn't get invited to so much, so, you know, maybe your parents could invite him over.
Well, I didn't get the invite for Specs Deck either, so I mean, you know, I'm just kind of covering with a story that I was busy, but I didn't get the invite either. So, you know, I'm doing Jason's show a couple times for him, but no invite to the deck party. I'm a little bit choked.
You know what? And here I was just having fun, and I seem to have, you know, picked away at a scar a little bit. That's okay.
Yeah.
we know the Oil Kings are going to lose Pesek and Christian Pelz. And what happens to a guy like Griffin Reinhart if there is a lockout? Would he come to camp here as opposed to the Islander camp?
Yeah, I would assume so. If there's no Islander camp to go to, I would think that's probably, if you're an Oil King fan, good news on that front for Griffin's sake, because he'll be in Edmonton and won't have to go away. You know, obviously he'll come to Oil King camp for the first few days and then head off to New York if everything goes well for the NHL. But and then, you know, gosh, who knows what happens with the New York Islanders, as we've kind of been talking about all summer. But yeah, if there's no camp to go to, he'll be here in Edmonton, and that'll be pretty easy decision, I guess.
They have a nice defense, and especially if Reinhardt does return, they lose Pesek, but they've got some quality there. Who do you see maybe stepping in and playing a bigger role, the Pesek role? I guess Reinhardt would be the guy, and then who would slip into his role?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. You know, you have Reinhardt and Gernat. You got to figure out who Keegan Lowe is going to play with, because he's played with Mark Pesek most of his career. Obviously, Ashton Sautner and Cody Corbett were there last year as well, and you expect them to sort of move up the depth chart a little bit. And then there's probably a spot open in the top six, whether that's a guy, you know, if Ryan Deck can come to camp and sort of grab that role. Mason Gertsen, I think, as Guy mentioned earlier with you, he's going to really be pushing for playing time as a 17-year-old, and got a taste last year, didn't play a lot. And then Guy also mentioned the two younger guys they have coming in, Aaron Irving and Dyson Mayo as well. I think, you know, one, maybe two of those guys could be on the roster. Who knows how camp goes, but they're going to have some options. And, you know, I know it's kind of a cliche that no job's safe, but they definitely have some young kids pushing. And I know it's a championship team coming back, but, you know, they're going to have some guys making, I think, some tough decisions on maybe some of the veteran guys that are going to be pushed this year.
With the lockout, Corey, there's going to be a lot more eyes, I think, on the Western Hockey League, and specifically the Oil Kings. How difficult it is, we're familiar with the National Hockey League and maybe even the AHL. How difficult is it to project who are the powerhouses are going to be year to year?
Yeah, I think it's, especially with the lockout, like you mentioned, you know, there could be some pretty good 20-year-olds still in this league next year if they decide, you know, let's say if Regina is, or if Los Angeles decides to send Jordan Wheel back to Regina instead of having him go and play in Manchester as a 20-year-old, you know, that changes things for the Pats. I mean, Mark Pesek's an interesting one with Buffalo. I still think he finds a way to make that Rochester team, but if he doesn't, you know, gosh, the Oil Kings get a huge gift of having him back as a 20-year-old. But I think it could be very interesting, Alan, especially early in the year with the amount of 20-year-olds kind of having the opportunity to come back and play in junior teams. And, you know, if you look at the Oil Kings, obviously, if you're the Sabres, maybe you're thinking that, wow, this kid could go and be the captain of this team. And you know, obviously, a team coming off a Memorial Cup berth, that maybe that's a good spot for him. But, again, it's tough for me to think that he would be back. But you never know, I guess, right now with kind of everything up in the air at the National Hockey League level. As well, the NHL, CHL deals expired too. So, you know, last lockout around, guys that were 19 years old that played in the league the year before, the National League, went to the American League. And you know, there's a question whether or not that would happen. I mean, gosh. I mean, Ryan Nugent-Hopkins is 19 years old. If there's no deal, could he be back in the Red Deer? I mean, that would be insane to even think that could happen. But, you know, there's lots of possibilities out there. I don't think anybody's completely got them all nailed down yet.
A couple of questions, actually three, around Mitch Marras. So I'm going to just condense them all into one here. Do you see him getting a significant top 9 minutes and maybe some power play time this year?
I think so, for sure. I think he's definitely a top nine. Probably will play some top 6 minutes at times. I just think the top nine is so deep right now that they're going to move guys in and out. And yeah, I think he's a guy like Mitch's hands are on the power play in front of the net. Like, I watch him in practice. When guys take shots from the point, the kid doesn't miss tipping a puck. So I think he'll be a big use in front of the net. They don't really have a really big body presence. I guess Mitch and Henrik can both do it, but Mitch, especially in front of the goal, I think you'll see that on the power play this year. At least I'd like to see it a little bit because, you know, like you said, he's second-round pick now, a lot of eyes on him, so you think he's going to get more offensive chances, and I think he deserves it for what he did last year.
Is there anybody, aside from Lazar, that we should be looking for draft-eligible for 2013 NHL draft-eligible?
Well, I guess Corbett and Sautner on the back end, who didn't get drafted this year, I think they're likely to get drafted next year. As you know, we saw this year, Alan, a lot of guys that missed the first year got drafted, kind of the older players. So I think if they have solid years, they'll be drafted again this time round. And who knows, the guy like Mason Gertsen, he's a big, physical, stay-at-home defenseman. He's going to have, I think, some eyes on him, as well as Tristan Jarry, the backup goaltender. If Laurent Brossoit can make that Team Canada, Jari's going to have a lot of starts in the middle of the year around Christmas time when Brossoit's gone, or even when he's gone to camp. So, you know, Jari's in his draft year, and he's been a highly ranked goaltender the whole time as well. So I think he'll get a sniff.
It's funny you mentioned Sautner. Guy Flaming had scouts on maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago, and I think they also mentioned Corbett too. One of the scouts said he was shocked that Sautner didn't get drafted. I guess for a player, that's probably impetus or inspiration to come into your 18-year-old season and just, you know, kick out the jams.
I think so. You know, Ashton was a rookie last year at the Western League level, and I think he expected to get drafted. And I think, you know, hey, I thought he would get drafted for sure. I was shocked that he didn't. So, you know, he played a lot with Reinhardt last year, and you got to think this year coming in as an 18-year-old, he went to the Minnesota Wilds development camp, so he's had a bit of a taste, but can now kind of sense what he needs to do to get to that next level. So I look for him. I really liked his game, Alan, later in the season, as he's just so calm at times with the puck in his own zone. Now, sometimes that hurt him. Sometimes he turned the puck over, but it's part of learning as a young defenseman. So I think you're going to see him kind of come back and have a real strong year this year.
What's your first broadcast on Team 1260 for the Oil Kings?
As far as I know, we're just going to start with opening night, and that would be September the 20th. The Oil Kings are going to have their banner night hosting the Kootenay Ice. That's the only game on the schedule that night, so all eyes in the Western League on the past two champions hooking up at Rexall.
You know what, Corey? I'm really looking forward to hearing you on the radio. I enjoy listening to you every winter, and this one's going to be a special one. Thanks for your time.
Hey, thanks, Alan. I can't wait. Thank you.
All right. That's Corey Graham from the Oil Kings play-by-play guy. You know, you might want to... I've got a few friends who are like, oh, you know, I got time to get some of my Oil Kings season tickets. Chances are these things are going because it's going to be one of the major events in town this year with the Oilers maybe not playing. So if you're planning on grabbing your Edmonton Oil Kings play or tickets, season tickets, you might want to do that as soon as possible because they're on sale and they'll be going quickly. Great entertainment. I have to tell you, I mentioned earlier to Guy that watching Martin Gernat developed last year. I probably saw him 7 or 8 times, but I saw him early 3 or 4 times and then later on in the season. And just to watch him develop as a player defensively and to become a little more rugged. He's a big guy and strong, but he was using his physical size a lot more later on in the year. So it's fun to watch these kids develop, and there's a bunch of really good ones draft eligibles on the Oil Kings this year. Okay, we're going to take a break. We've got a couple of different things we're mulling over doing here in the next segment. So we'll mull some more and be back with you in a minute. This is Nation Radio, brought to you by Edmonton Motors.
This is Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Presented by Edmonton Motors.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
It's 1:46. This is Nation Radio. We're around until 2:00 today, and then we're joined by Jungle Jim Hunter, 2 to 4, and then Jeff Grischel on the radio with Crush Sports Performance, and interesting stuff coming up this afternoon. We have this. This is off the blog from Adam. One thought has been rolling around in my head is this. Cates owns 4 sports teams, 3 of which are absolutely dominant in their sport league, and one of which has been not so good. He says dismal, but not so good. The Capitals won their league, though are now on a hiatus for 1 year. The Oil Kings similarly won the WHL title, and the Barons rode to conference finals in a very tough league. The Oilers, on the other hand, have been terrible throughout his ownership, despite being the crowning jewel in Cates sports. Do we assume then that Cates is simply unable to manage a team in such a high-tier league, that he's blinded by the admiration for Lowe's glory days and thus refuses to make necessary changes that he would otherwise make? Or do we maybe think there's more going on that we don't see? Well, here's my answer, okay? I think that Darryl Cates, when he first came in as the owner, there was the idea that they could compete. This was a team that was only a couple of years away from going to the Stanley Cup Finals because he took over, I believe, in the summer of 2008. The Pronger trade set them back just chronologically. It was a trade for younger players, Lupul and Smead and draft picks, and that trade, without replacing defensemen using the dollars, basically meant Edmonton was very young and inconsistent on the blue line, and it had an impact. There were injuries. Rolison got hurt, and Garon came in, and a lot of other things happened, but that was the bottom line. They took a big step backward once Pronger had been traded. So you arrive at 2008 with Darryl Cates and still trying to, you know, put it together and get back into the playoffs. By, I think it was the middle or maybe February of 2010, the 09-10 season, when Cates, according to the Oil Chains episode, said, you know, maybe we should just rebuild. And from that point forward, I think they've had, and they've mentioned, I believe Kevin Lowe has, for sure, mentioned a 5-year rebuild. So we're basically in year 3 or summer 3 of the rebuild. And that involved doing exactly what Edmonton has done, which you can call scorched earth or, you know, rebuilding by, you know, offloading veteran players like Surrey and Dustin Penner, and those sorts of players, and going through the draft however you want to call it. That's basically it. They're gathering assets similar to the way Chicago or the Pittsburgh Penguins, ideally. That's a really good comparable when we're talking about a rebuild, not necessarily the results, but that's what they basically have been doing. Now, aside from that, as a fan, you're also aware of the arena construction, and you can build in all kinds of scenarios where, they're not going to win any games until the new arena comes in. I honestly don't believe that was part of it. I think they really felt that they were a poor club in the 09-10 season, and that no matter what happened, they weren't going to be able to sign enough players, even through offer sheets or whatever the case may be, to get back where they wanted to be, competing with Calgary and Minnesota and Colorado for second place in the Northwest Division. So at that point in time, Cates talks about it, and Steve Tambolini and Kevin Lowe, they begin the process of obviously spending more time and hiring more scouts because you want to be better at that. Come the 2010 draft, they pick up Taylor Hall and then some nice secondary things as well. I think that 2010 draft was a really good one, and we'll find out in the next few years, but there were some good players there. Marincin, Hamilton, Tyler Pitlick, coming along as well. So Brandon Davidson in that draft. And then 2011, much the same, 10-11, you got Taylor Hall to show everybody, a great player, and obviously Eberle and Pajarvi graduate that year as well. But it's still young and making mistakes, and you end up finishing 30th overall and drafting Ryan Nugent Hopkins and Oscar Klefbom, two really fine young players. Nuge is a great young player. He's inserted into the lineup right away at 18, and through the games that he played, he showed outstanding talent. We talked to Jonathan Willis about that. Now the 11-12 season comes along, and there's the expectation that they'll be better, but there hasn't been the gathering of veterans yet. And I think that they're not a cap team. Darryl Cates isn't throwing good money after bad. They're paying out off the Surrey contract, and they've brought in, other people. But I think the last big contract that they signed was Nikolai Habibulin, who's in the fourth year coming up of a four-year deal. So these have all been short-term. Boulanger, Eager, all those guys are short-term contracts. The big money contracts are the ones Kevin Lowe signed, Sean Horkoff as an example. Even the Ryan Smith contract that has just been signed here, the two-year deal, isn't for a lot of money. They've been building towards a better tomorrow is what they've been doing from the beginning. So long story short, the answer, I think, to your question is that Darryl Cates did have a plan starting in 2010. It involved losing a lot of games. That's what we've seen. I don't think they anticipated the coaching ups and downs that they had. I think that most people would agree that the Pat Quinn hiring was a mistake, not because Pat Quinn's a bad guy, just because the types of things that you have to teach a young team, like, how to, come out of your zone and all those sorts of things. Quinn was a taskmaster about, and maybe not the kind of X and O's guy that the young players needed. Remember what happened with Lubomir Visnovsky? They ended up trading him out of town, and he was the one guy who could lug the the puck out of the zone. So you got Steve Staios ripping that puck around there even harder, and Joffrey Lupul trying to get it out. I mean, it was kind of comical and sad at the same time, but that was all part of the process. So they learned about Pat Quinn. I think Rennie is a good coach. I just think that time maybe ran out on him, and they decided to make another move. At some level, I think that Ralph Kruger impressed them so much that they said, you know what, we're going to go ahead and grab this guy. He's good enough. We're gonna take care of business with Ralph Kruger, and we'll see how that works. You lose a coach like Tom Rennie or let go of him, he's hired by Detroit basically the next day. He's a quality guy. Kruger is somebody who has inspired a lot of positives from the players, from the management, and I think his interviews, Jason Gregor interviewed him a few weeks ago. The guy is clearly, on point with regard to how to develop a young team. So I think there's a confidence level there, but I can't honestly say right now that the Edmonton Oilers at this moment are convinced they're even going to try for the playoffs. Although they've signed Justin Schultz, that's a great signing this summer. They drafted Neil Yakupov. I think that was the right guy. Ryan Smith is a great signing. You remember when Steve Tambolini was talking about this team for next year, he had mentioned early on about two defensemen. Now, we haven't heard that so much. After the Justin Schultz signing, there was we definitely have to get a top four defenseman. And then there was talk about Mark Mathot, who some of us don't really feel is a top four defenseman, although the payment that Columbus got for him is definitely ranking in the top four. So there seems to be a little bit of disconnect between maybe what the fans want, which is to compete for a playoff spot right away, and what the Oilers are doing, which appears to me to be they're staying on the five-year plan, and this coming up will be year number four, and they'll start competing for a Stanley Cup in year number five. That's the long and the short of it. So your answer, Adam, is I think they are they have a plan, just like they did with the other three other franchises. This one is wider in scope. The template involves more years and more draft picks as opposed to free agent signings and acquisitions. But that's based on the fact that you simply have to wait for Taylor Hall to drive the bus. He's there now, and you've got Eberle and the Nuge and Yakupov up front, and maybe you need a few other pieces on defense, maybe Seth Jones. I don't think the Oilers will be in a position to draft him this year, but maybe it's a matter of Oscar Klefbom coming over and Martin Marincin getting enough experience in Oklahoma City so that they can contribute a year from now, and Devin Dubnyk getting a little more confidence and maybe improving that backup goaltending too. They're not far away, but if they were really on the idea of making the playoffs this year, they would, I think, as Jonathan mentioned, maybe, you know, done a little more to upgrade the defense, which had been talked about early on. And you can say it was difficult or not available to them, but there are free agent defensemen still out there. One was signed this week, but there's still others out there who should be able to help the Edmonton Oilers if they were really interested in making the playoffs this year. Not saying they're not going to try to, but I don't think that all hands are on deck and all cannons are pointing in the same direction with the Oilers, because that's not the plan. And you know, I think Darryl Cates knows what he's doing. And I think this is going to be a hell of a hockey team over the next decade, and I'm looking forward to watching them a lot. For this year, though, it might be, at least at the beginning, Edmonton Oil Kings and Oklahoma City Barons, and that's not so bad. Okay, so 154. I hope I answered your question, Adam. I suspect that I over-answered it, but that's okay. I want to thank our guests, Derek Zona, Corey Pronman, Guy Flaming, Jonathan Willis, and Corey Graham. And, of course, Connor Halley, who did a great job not staying out late at Specs Deck, but being in here and working so hard with me, and I appreciate that. Next week, we'll have Tom Lynn on the show, also Ken Simpson, as we count down to Oil Kings and get ready for what is going to be a wonderful season. Thanks so much for tuning into Nation Radio. We are, of course, brought to you by Edmonton Motors, and we're back next Saturday at high noon. Have a great weekend.